Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren tried to read a letter penned by Coretta Scott King in the well of the Senate, and an objecting Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell decided that she should receive the maximum amount of attention she possibly could by silencing her on the floor right then and there. Smooth move, Ex-Lax, for out of this dust-up, a new slogan of resistance was born. Meanwhile, you've probably noticed that Donald Trump's White House is maybe the leakiest one in memory. And this week, the Huffington Post told the story of the president making oddball late-night calls and complaining about the quality of Air Force One hand towels. But hey, should you be concerned by any of this? Well, the people who keep leaking these stories are pretty concerned. Finally, as you may have heard, one of the more potent members of Trump's inner circle is former Breitbart News media maven Steve Bannon, who is a different sort of conservative from your standard issue Beltway Republicans. One way in which he differs, he's a full-on apocalypticist who believes America should be getting ready to fight multiple, potentially world-ending wars, which is probably going to be news to those Trump voters who thought they were electing a war critic who'd keep us out of such conflicts. Well, we're going to delve into where Bannon gets his ideas from, and I'll warn you in advance, you won't be feeling too optimistic by the time we're done, so it will be just like all of our other podcasts. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Paul Blumenthal, Zach Carter, SV Date, and Arthur Delaney. And here's what happened first. Hey guys, guess what? It's So That Happened, another podcast about politics, only this one is a little bit more dour than all the others. My name is Jason Linkins. I am the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post, and joining us this week, as always, well, as most of the time, we have Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And we have Zachary Carter.
We're all still alive.
We did it. We made it through another one of these weeks, man. It's going to be a long one, but one day at a time. So we got to start right away. This week, the resistance got itself a new shiny slogan.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
And who was it that was so persistent? Well, you've probably heard about her. Her name is Elizabeth Warren. She's a senator from Massachusetts. And this week, she was pretty angry, right?
Yeah, there was a debate about confirming Senator Jeff Sessions to be the next Attorney General of the United States.
Who was too racist to be a judge in 1986. And as an example of that, Coretta Scott King sent a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee about how Sessions had suppressed voting by black people by prosecuting them.
And so Warren was reading this letter on the Senate floor.
This letter, which Strom Thurmond had not put into the record. Senator Strom Thurmond essentially suppressed the letter in a sense. And so apropos of Jeff Sessions getting nominated to be the Attorney General, Democrats, this letter had been hidden until recently. It came out recently.
Right.
And so they're going to read into the record, which is where it belonged all along. So Elizabeth Warren started reading it. And then we had a little bit of a procedural parliamentary thing.
Mr. President.
They are.
Mr. President.
The majority leader.
The senator is impugning the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Mr. President.
Senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate.
Okay, so a couple things. One, they're saying Mr. President because that's just what in the Senate you call the presiding person.
Sure, sure.
It's just another senator. This is for people who don't watch C-SPAN 3. And Rule 19 is a famous rule. It's also sort of arcane and obscure, but it's the idea that senators, it's a deliberative body and they're really nice to each other. They don't say mean things directly to each other. They don't even call each other by name. They say the senator from Delaware or the senator from Massachusetts or the senator from Kentucky. So Republicans, you know, this is selectively enforced, but Elizabeth Warren, because she said Jeff Sessions' name and mean stuff about him, is being called out for violating this rule.
I mean, you could say that's one way of putting it. She said mean stuff about Jeff Sessions. She impugned Jeff Sessions. Another way of putting it would be to say that she was simply being factually accurate about a guy's political record.
Oh, I mean, she didn't. She was reading a letter in which the word Jeff Sessions
kind of like
is somebody else's word.
Jeff Sessions kind of impugned himself with his actions.
Any political
over
debate
the course of his career
over whether he will be appointed. Let's remember
but
that.
Okay, it's so good that we have these.
It's a quirk that the person they're talking about for attorney general also happens to be a senator who is still in the Senate.
Right.
So that's a weird thing is going on there.
Right.
But let's emphasize the selectiveness of this enforcement. I mean, Ted Cruz is in the Senate. He just calls Harry Reid a liar all the time.
They called Mitch McConnell a liar.
So it's just, you know, he doesn't get Rule 19 down, you know.
No, so that was the whole thing here is that why did Mitch McConnell do this? It backfired so epically at a time when the Democratic base is having women's marches to tell a woman to sit down and shut up and then explain it with this incredible catchphrase. Nevertheless, she persisted. Instant rallying cry.
I got to say, that was like your John Boehner imitation. That was not a good Mitch McConnell.
It was sort of a hybrid. It was okay.
Yeah.
You know,
work on it. I appreciate the effort.
She persisted. That's
a little bit better. That's a little bit better. I do not do impressions. It is kind of curious because, you know, what ended up happening was that a bunch of other senators just read Coretta Scott King's letter in the well of the Senate, and a bunch of male senators did. And so it was kind of interesting because her colleagues took up that task that people said the press and the briefing need to do. It's like when you're shut down, the next person asks the same question, the next person does the same thing. So it was an interesting moment of collective action among the Democrats. And I thought it really, really puzzling, too, that McConnell did this, because had Elizabeth Warren simply read Coretta Scott King's letter, it may have been noted by a few, you know, media outlets hither and yon. But
the Huffington Post.
It certainly wouldn't have taken on this kind of crazy life of its own that it has now. It's almost as if Mitch McConnell's never heard of what people call the Streisand effect, which is when you try to suppress a piece of information, you can easily have it backfire and become more widely known.
You mean like when Barbara Streisand
shut down this website that had photographs of beachfront properties, including hers, because they were studying soil erosion. And someone was like, you know, your house is on that. And she made a big deal about trying to get this guy to take this picture that had her house in it down off of this website, and it ended up getting reported on.
Everyone looked at her house.
And then everyone looked at her house, you know, which is stupid. It's called Let Some Shit Slide is like the
Mitch
opposite.
Mitch McConnell was like, we didn't rule 19 the male Democratic senators who read the letter because it was actually Warren's preamble to reading the letter that they were so offended
by. Sure, sure.
Also, it was just such an epic disaster for McConnell that in the wake of it, there were several conservative media outlets and taking this line from an anonymous Republican staffer that actually it was all going according to his plan.
This is the best.
To elevate Elizabeth Warren, the great villain of moderate voters, which I don't particularly find very plausible.
It's nuts. It's nuts. It is true that within the conservative, the people who read conservative media, you know, we're talking places like, you know, the Federalist, like, you know, the National Review, these places. She is not popular. But these people live in a relatively small bubble of conservative media consumers. Outside of that bubble, Elizabeth Warren is like one of the most popular politicians in the United States.
Well, elevating an opponent that you would find more favorable for a future contest is his political strategy, but it just, I don't think that's what was going on here.
There's no, she's no popular. Chance. No, yeah. One, she's popular. Two, I mean, look, if you talk to people who know McConnell, they had been debating sessions for hours at this point in time. Sometimes politicians aren't playing 12-dimensional chess. Sometimes they just get tired and do something stupid.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're just frustrated. You know, I think that's what happened.
Sessions still got confirmed, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Have we had – I want to just let's step on to the theory of Warren's popularity just for a second. Because have we had a really good test case of whether Warren, who can easily be depicted by Republicans anyway as a coastal elite, she's a Harvard professor, she's from Oklahoma, but she's lived in Massachusetts her entire life. It's and of course she talks about economic populism and has a sort of anti-Wall Street agenda most of the time. Do we have any kind of like test cases for Elizabeth Warren actually going into the hinterlands, the flyover country, and making a big splash? Because right off the bat, I think that I'll accept your notion that maybe she's culturally out of touch with middle America, but I'll want you to get back to me when she's actually stumping in middle America and offering people on the spot financial advice, which is something she can do.
We have that. Economic populism is the thing that we know plays well everywhere. It's what got Trump elected. Also, we have the test case of Republicans trying to stop Elizabeth Warren from being the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and winding up with her in the Senate as a result.
Yeah. Well,
they wouldn't necessarily have been able to field a Democrat other than her, who could have beaten Scott Perry. She's popular.
All right, fair enough. I think there'll be future tests for Elizabeth Warren to come as to whether her message translates to middle America, but I'm not as skeptical as a lot of people are. So back to this thing. One of the things that's really interesting to me is that far from a crazy, super-duper 11th-dimensional chess plan that McConnell had to, you know, flummox his opponents, obviously, what's happened in the wake of this is the sort of movement that's been on a regular basis coming together and coalescing across America in the streets to oppose Donald Trump and oppose some of his policies got new wind in their sails, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, that's the context of this.
Yeah. And look, what's been happening is, you know, the Women's March is the first really big thing that happened after the inauguration. 1.2 million women came to D.C. for that. Pretty amazing number of people. They keep getting people who came to that march and other marches around the country keep getting new reasons and excuses to organize and mobilize for different events. So there were a bunch of vigils held that were anti-Sessions vigils that one of the organizers of the Women's March helped coordinate in like 55 different congressional districts. This event with McConnell shutting down Warren on the floor is now creating a bunch of She Persists t-shirts, which are being sold everywhere. Kirsten Gillibrand is fundraising off of it. Move On is fundraising off of it. It is elevated the level of energy in the sort of activist community. Just giving them a new reason to be out there.
And there's a further context. There's a mini consensus forming that this is a parallel on the left to what Republicans had with the Tea Party starting in 2009 as a base driven backlash to the establishment and the opposing party.
And yet, bad news, everyone. Jeff Sessions was confirmed as Attorney General.
Oh yeah,
there's not a whole lot Democrats are going to be able to do about that. You only need a majority of votes. I mean, they don't have a majority. So, I mean, they're going to lose all of these fights on the Senate floor. The one area where they have a chance to win is in influencing public opinion. And on that front, this was a pretty good week for Democrats.
They also, it's worth pointing out, they came historically close to tanking a nominee.
That's true.
It was the first time ever you'd have the vice president come to the Senate to cast a tiebreaker.
And this is for Betsy DeVos, the education secretary. Yeah. You know, it's interesting to me. I've long had this theory about Democrats and what they've kind of done wrong over the past few years, in that their compromising nature has led the public perception of what they stand for to be watered down. Now, I think they've often act that way for virtuous reasons. They want to get laws passed. They want to get half a loaf. But what we see right now is they're taking L's legislatively. They're not, you know, DeVos is confirmed, Sessions is confirmed. Everyone who Trump has put forward is going to get confirmed. But they are still now leaving the impression that they actually stand for something. And people know far and wide what the Democrats stood for on this particular occasion. And if things go bad because of these nominees, people will remember who had the alternative point of view on the matter.
And just to get back to the point about Warren, being the face of this, who would you rather have be the face of a sort of populist activist backlash to the Republican government? Would you rather it be Chuck Schumer, or would you rather it be Elizabeth Warren?
You would have Elizabeth Warren 6 days a week, twice on Sunday.
And they're working together. I mean, the Democratic leadership gets this stuff. Now, they're being pulled by the nose by the people in their party who are out in the streets, but they're coming along.
Nevertheless.
Okay, we're going to work on that. Arthur, we're going to work on that.
She persisted.
I admire the effort. She what matters is the effort. Okay, well, guys, thanks for this. We have a great show. You should stick around to listen to it.
You should persist.
Enough.
Persist yourself once.
Enough.
Persist yourself two times.
Persist yourself for like 20, 25 more minutes, and I promise you'll have a great time. We will be right back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
And we're back. So you've heard it said that nothing good ever happens after midnight. Decisions you make. Well, unfortunately for us, at least from the standpoint of people who don't want to have a wild and crazy thrill ride of chaos, our president likes to go to bed early and then get up way in the dead of night to start making decisions. And apparently, sometime in January, he made a 3 a.m. phone call. And here to talk about this is Arthur Delaney.
Hello.
And joining us for the second or third time, we have SV Date.
Hey there.
Who, along with Christina Wilkie, broke this very, very wild story about Donald Trump waking up in the middle of the night, picking up the phone, making calls.
Story of the week.
Yeah. Take us through this incident.
Right. Well, the president had some questions about the dollar, the American dollar, and whether having a strong one was good for the economy, or was it a weak one? Was that better for the economy?
Classic question.
It is an important question. Macroeconomic question. You'd want the president to know the right answer.
Definitely call an economist to talk about it.
Economist. Why would you do that when you've got your national security advisor that you can call at 3 a.m. and ask him that question, a lieutenant general, retired general in the United States Army, who answered, I don't know. I don't really know much about the dollar. Why don't you try calling an economist?
Wait a minute. The president at 3 a.m. called his national security advisor.
That's right.
Michael Flynn.
Right.
And said, which one is good, a strong dollar or a weak dollar?
Sure.
And so Flynn said, call an economist.
Right. You guys think this is funny. Why?
Why didn't you call an economist in the first place?
Why didn't you wait till the morning to ask about the strong or weak dollar. Why didn't you know that going in?
Right.
I mean, we were talking about this before. There's evidence that Donald Trump knew full well that from the stand, well, that just to give the audience a primer on this, strong versus weak dollar, it is simply a reflection on how our currency is trading in forex markets against other currencies. When we call it, whether we call it strong or weak, we're referring to the trade-off that comes when our dollar is able to buy up more of a foreign currency than the reverse.
Oh, right. Okay. That's strong, the value of imports.
A good way to explain this is in terms of Trump himself.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
In January, saying the strong dollar is bad, it's that message fits with his entire economic pitch during the campaign, which was that the strong dollar and the correspondingly weak currencies in other countries is hurting our exporters and therefore our manufacturers and therefore our blue-collar workers who have high salaries in factories.
If you want high wages and more jobs, you would prefer a weak dollar versus a strong dollar.
Right.
So it's weird. To me, I think it's funny. Not ha-ha funny, but
funny. Like, oh, no.
More like funny. Because it's something he previously articulated, something he would be in the position to know about based on his business career, and yet he wakes up in the middle of the night, I guess, suffused with the confusion, and the only way to resolve it would be call Michael Flynn.
Right. Well, maybe he had his speed dial up last. I don't know why, Michael Flynn. And I don't know why 3 a.m. that question came to him. Maybe there was something on cable at that moment. Have we checked? Maybe at 2:50 a.m. there was something about the dollar and why, you know, we weren't getting enough exports. So, you know, the point
like
is
a really
though,
compelling shake weight infomercial that bothered him.
Right.
Sure. It's possible.
So Shirish, you and Christina Wilkie, this was a multi-part scoop, this story that, you know, everyone else in media politics was following the story after you filed it this week. The other part of it was that Trump is complaining about the hand towels.
Yeah, they're not nice enough, evidently. They're not soft enough.
These are the hand towels on Air Force One.
That's right. And by the way, these would be actual towels made of terry cloth. They are not paper towels.
Paper towels are what most people get on an airplane.
Right. Or sometimes even at home.
Well, but Trump has had his own plane for a while.
He has.
Presumably he had hand towels.
I wouldn't know. But yeah, perhaps he had much nicer towels than they have on Air Force
One. So, you have been on Air Force One.
And the towels are, in my view, are just fine. They are terry cloth. They do the job. They don't have any Air Force logo on them, Air Force One, because otherwise everyone, like myself, would steal one.
Is he complaining that they don't have logos or that the thread count is bad?
I think it's the thread count. So, I think that.
So what's better, a strong towel or a weak towel? You'd want the weak towel, right? Because that would mean it's softer.
I mean,
the towels are too strong. Sure. It's hurting my hand, my dainty, small hand.
So you guys have had kind of a debate about which one of these deserves you the most, and you are like...
I think the 3 a.m. phone call with a macroeconomic question to your national security advisor is more disconcerting than the hand towel.
And you're going to give me the case for the towels?
I think if I'm the commander-in-chief, president of the United States, I think I get over the towels. I'm flying around on Air Force One. I think maybe I say, you know what, this is pretty great. And if the towels aren't quite as luxurious, Egyptian cotton, sure. I'll live with it.
Not for nothing, but in Michael Lewis's famous interview with President Barack Obama, Obama talked about how he had to distill decisions and concerns down to a few bare rudimentary things to think about every day in order to do his job. So there's a case to be made for why you shouldn't be – you shouldn't the thought of towels shouldn't even occur to you when you're the president of the United States.
All right, tiebreaker. I think the 3 a.m. phone call on strong dollar is weirder. Shirish thinks the hand towel complaining is weirder.
So
which one do you think is weirder, Jason?
Okay, I'm going to say that what's weird to me is that – this White House is super duper leaky.
Okay, fine, but don't dodge this tie break.
No, I dodged it. No,
come on.
Boom, dodged.
Which one's weirder, man?
Boom, dodged. I've segued. Sorry. That's a skill.
Just a very elegant.
Wow, that was some real Washington stuff right
Got
there.
Got it. Point of privilege for the host.
Drain the swamp.
No. So we should talk about this. This has been a very, very leaky White House.
It has.
And one of the things that you and Christina Wilkie obviously worked to confirm this story and corroborate it, and it's corroborated everyone's satisfaction. And one of the big reasons why is, first and foremost, Michael Flynn has regaled people with this story.
Yeah, he loves telling it. And I can see why that would be a nice conversation starter if you're Michael Flynn and you're starting a meeting with the NSC staff or other folks and say, look, I know I ask a lot of you people. I demand a lot. I make you work long hours. But look, here's what I got to deal with, all right? You guys aren't called at 3 a.m. and ask an off-topic question that you know nothing about. I am. And so we're all in the same boat. So that it makes total sense why he would use this anecdote. Why I find out about the anecdote and others are finding about similar anecdotes, that's a real question. Because typically when you start a new presidential administration, the kind of leaks you get are, you know, this staffer's kind of a bozo and he's really doing his job badly.
Power struggles among
exactly, right.
top
or,
staffers.
Or sometimes within the agencies, you'll have leaks about a particular policy that they think is a disaster and they want to try to scuttle it right front.
And we have had, some,
had
of those.
Some of those. Yeah. But rarely do you see the kind of leaks that we're seeing a lot of, not just us. We've seen these in the New York Times, the Washington Post, elsewhere. Right. You know, the strange phone calls with foreign leaders. We have him obsessing over what type of window coverings he's going to want and doesn't care at all about what's in the executive orders because he doesn't read them.
Also, he said that the phones in the White House are the most beautiful phones he's ever seen.
Phones. Right, right.
Who says that?
And the briefings have to be one page long, bullet points with no more than 9 bullet points on it.
With
page.
A lot of white space around each bullet point.
So, right. what are the leakers motivated by here?
The sense is there's something wrong with our president, and everyone ought to know this because there's going to come a time when a major decision is going to have to be made, and we are all going to have to think about the rational thought process or lack thereof that got us there.
That's really disturbing. Now, people talked about this during the campaign, and there was like a consensus that it's rude to question someone's sanity. It's unethical for doctors to play along with these stories because Donald Trump is not their patient.
You know,
but now what's going on?
If you want to get into a bit of crying wolf, too, we'll say that there was a persistent drumbeat in some quarters when John McCain was running for president that he had kind of like lost his marbles. There was no compelling evidence of this. Certainly, we didn't get the kind of like leaks from within or just outside the room saying, I don't know about John McCain that we're getting from Trump.
People were just being
agents. It is something, saying, yeah, sure, but this is something that people talk about. It's just that we've never seen it talked about with this kind of alacrity. Yeah. Or
The last time we've had these sorts of concerns aired as near publicly as they have been was the final year of the Richard Nixon presidency, right? I mean, after everything was going downhill and he was kind of brooding in the White House kind of by himself, similar to what we have now already. We had questions about, is the president okay? I mean, he's not himself. And we had leaks from, you know, the top staff in the White House back in 1974. We're only 3 weeks in, guys, and we're seeing similar types of concerns from similar types of people.
Yeah.
Out right now.
I have to say, you know, some of the other details and stories like yours and stories that I've read about this describe a president who, leaving his rational thought process aside, leaving aside the fact that he's calling Michael Flynn up at 3 a.m., he appears to be someone who is now more and more trapped inside a bubble of his own creation. There's talk about how he's alone at night most nights, kind of wandering the White House. Doesn't know his, and it's okay he doesn't know his way around the White House. He's only been there for a few weeks. But the fact that he's so isolated, so by himself, so left alone for periods of time to do nothing but watch cable news and tweet about things, it has given me this kind of Jack Torrance at the Overlook Hotel vibe. You know, yeah. You've always been the caretaker.
Yeah, right.
That's the kind of like weird sensation.
This is The Shining, everybody.
And like, I do think I've never really gotten the impression that Donald Trump has many friends.
No.
I mean someone who cares about him deeply and will tell him the hard truths about things. I feel like if he had one of those people, someone would have said, look, you were not cut out for this job. This is a lot of work. You don't like work. You like the path of least resistance. Do you know what it's like to be president? You take stick all the time. You have to eat shit on a daily basis. Do you really want that? And now I see him in the White House. He's surrounded by hangers-on, opportunists, certainly by the roomful, but no real friend. Right. And his wife is not in the White House with him. His son is not in the White House with him. Obviously, it was his youngest son. Obviously, his family are still sort of like hanging around. Jared and Ivanka are in town. But I don't get the sense that he has someone who just can be, I don't know, keep him from being isolated and turning inward all the time. That's what bugs me.
Yeah, and that's a point that actually Elliot Cohen, who I quoted in the story, who was in the George W. Bush White House. He was actually in the State Department. He was one of the top lawyers there. He was also on the National Security Council Deputies Committee. He pointed out that, look, every president who's been elected since Nixon, actually, or has been in the White House since then, including, you know, Gerald Ford, have had folks who like and respect him and just are not going to be disloyal at all because they like him too much. And that's been true certainly with Obama over the last 8 years. Sure. It's certainly true with George W. Bush, Reagan, George H.W. Bush. And what you point out, he doesn't have a lot of friends. That's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many of these leaks, that nobody in that inner circle right now feels, this is my bud and I've known him for years and I'm not going to say anything that's going to hurt him. That isn't there, which may be a good thing, actually, for the rest of America, because we're actually seeing a more unvarnished look of what's going on. But in terms of his mental health, I agree with you. I mean, to be wandering around alone at night in a job that maybe you really didn't think you were going to get and you really totally didn't want, I don't know.
Now, there are constitutional provisions for removing a president who's incapacitated.
Sure.
But too soon? Too soon?
Too soon.
Too soon.
Yeah. I'll point out that Friday, February 10th, is the 50th anniversary of the 25th Amendment. It's ratified by Minnesota and Nevada. Put it over the top. We have it. It's a good thing.
Too soon.
Too soon, I guess. But it's not too soon. It's just that anybody who has a real deep and personal connection to this man, reach out and talk to him, because he's alone and seemingly he's not taking to it that well. Okay. Sharish, thanks for joining us. This was
my pleasure.
Quite a story. Credit to you and Christina Wilkie for ferreting this out. And I hope people read it. And if there's more of these kind of stories to come, I hope that they come soon. All right, Arthur, thanks. And we will be right back. Hello, So That Happened listeners. I want to just take a moment to ask you to do a few small favors. First, if you like the show and want to help more people find it, go over to iTunes and just leave us a review. Every review we get bumps the show a little bit higher on the podcast charts. It does make a difference, and it's going to help us build this community. Second, are there issues you'd like us to address? People you think we should talk to? You should drop us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. We really do appreciate your suggestions, and we often follow up on stories, and we just like hearing feedback and criticism. So we'd love to hear from you specifically, because you're the people that matter the most to us. Now, back to the show.
This is the fourth great crisis in American history. We had the Revolution, we had the Civil War, we had the Great Depression of World War II. This is the great fourth turning in American history.
You have an expansionist Islam, and you have an expansionist China, and they think the Judeo-Christian West is on the retreat.
We're at the very beginning stages of a very brutal and bloody conflict.
We're going to war in the South China Sea in 5 to 10 years, aren't we?
Remember, divine providence reigns on the just and the unjust. Your cause is just.
And we're back. You've just been listening to a lot of weird rants from Steve Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News, who now is one of President Trump's key advisors. What we learned this week is only deepened understanding of what Steve Bannon is and does. He's an apocalypticist. He believes that we're inevitably headed to some kind of global confrontation with either the Islamic faith or China. Pick your poison. And the fact that he is going to be advising Trump on foreign policy makes this a kind of scary time for us all. Here to talk about this is Zach Carter.
Hi, everyone.
Loves talking about the scary time we live in. and Paul Blumenthal, who this week has written a story about Bannon and his unique worldview. So, Paul, what's rattling around in this guy's cage?
So I guess what I wrote about this week was a book that Bannon has repeatedly made reference to in his past speeches, movies he's made, and radio interviews, called The Fourth Turning. And it's a 1997 book by two generational theorists, William Strauss and Neil Howe, who basically came up with this cyclical theory of American history, that it moves from crisis point to a kind of awakening and then to an unraveling and then to another crisis point. And essentially, they said in 1997 that America would be entering another one of these crisis points around 2005. And, you know, somewhere in the early 2000s, I believe Steve Bannon, you know, kind of cottoned to this theory. And it really pops up in a lot of his work. He made a movie called Generation Zero, which basically states that this fourth turning, this new crisis moment, started on September 18th, 2008, when Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke went up to Capitol Hill and asked for Congress to bail out the banks. That, you know, this was an extreme crisis moment where the American people had actually caused their own self-destruction through greed other actions, that we essentially destroyed our own economic system. So he believes that that started this crisis moment. And within these crisis moments, the past ones that Strauss and Howe have identified are the American Revolution, the Civil War, the Great Depression, and World War II. What you notice about these crisis moments is that they involve escalating levels of violence. Yeah. And Bannon seems to be interested in this concept that this crisis moment, like past crisis moments, will need an escalating level of violence. And in a lot of his language, he talks about we're at war. I mean, there's literally a quote of him describing how he operated Breitbart, which was, it's war, it's war. Every day we're at war. We tell people America is at war. You know, he says we're in a 100-year struggle with radical Islam. He said, you know, we're going to war in the South China Sea in 10 to 15 years. Aren't we asking?
5 to 10.
Oh, five to 10. Okay. So within the Trump administration, perhaps. I mean, I think it's interesting that he has talked about, clearly has ingested and believes in this kind of apocalyptic theory about the current moment. And here he is basically as the top aide, writing rules, writing executive orders for the president of the United States with this sort of this completely apocalyptic belief.
So we've heard over the past few days about how ISIS has actually been celebrating this Muslim ban. They call it the Blessed Ban. And they're very, very excited about it. And you would think, well, it's probably not a good foreign policy decision to give ISIS a win here. But when you consider it through the prism of Steve Bannon and his worldview, one thinks that perhaps it's being done intentionally to sort of foment more violence between us and ISIS. Is that possibilities?
Well, I mean, you know, like ISIS is one of their grand goals is to eliminate this thing called the gray zone. And the gray zone is essentially an area where Muslims, Christians, secular people, Europe, the Muslim world can get along. And, you know,
and
like where we actually, you know, can discuss and relate to each other. And, you know, they want to polarize every Muslim against every European, against every American, against every Christian. They want a crusading war. And it seems in a lot of ways that Bannon and a lot of the people that he associates with want the same thing. And, you know, just from a different perspective. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there who would like to, you know, keep the gray zone, who would like to prevent Europe and America and the
the mountain of conflict.
Exactly. As you know, as Bannon calls it, the Judeo-Christian West, from, you know, going on a crusading war against the Muslim world. You know, I think, you know, this is Pope Francis's, one of his main goals is to prevent this from happening.
Zach, what's kind of incredible to me is that a lot of people who voted for Trump, and I mean a lot of them, voted for him precisely because they thought he'd keep us out of crazy wars. A lot of people have come to me and said, You don't understand. We voted for Trump because Hillary Clinton is a super hawk. She's going to keep us embedded in dumb wars. We don't want that. And I've never been able to figure out where they got the signal from Trump that he's some kind of dove. But
well, I mean, Trump on foreign policy and on economic policy, he would talk out of both sides of his mouth. I mean, he would say on one day that, you know, the Iraq war was a terrible mistake, a stupid war that we never should have gotten involved in. And he's not going to get us involved in dumb wars. And on the other, he would say, you know, we're going to bomb the shit out of them as his solution to all problems. You know, on economic policy, he would say, you know, those bankers, they're killers one day and the other, you know, later in the same freaking speech, he'd say, and that's why I'm going to repeal Dodd-Frank. You know, he did this the whole time. So people who wanted to pick and choose from obviously contradictory statements were able to do that. But I think one of the things that's interesting about Bannon is that for a long time, I and others have believed that his exploitation of this populist uprising that happened after the financial crisis has really been brilliant. I mean, it's kind of horrifying, but it was also really smart. It was something the Democratic Party sort of just missed the cultural signals that were happening there.
Sure, they're still steeped in third way nonsense.
Exactly. Yeah. Didn't see
and
that
literally
this was,
ran a Clinton for president.
Didn't see that this was an interesting moment. And these elements of this, you know, these fourth crises and stuff that these guys lay out in this quack theory. Look, it is true that the American Revolution was followed by the Civil War, which was followed by World War II.
Right.
and then Steve Bannon's right again that was followed by the financial crisis. But anytime you have these people start talking about cyclical theories, good things are followed by bad things unless everything ends or we enter, some period of eternal grace. There will always be cycles of good and bad. Good things will follow bad things and they will follow again. That's just how the concepts work. And the fact that Steve Bannon thinks that the financial crisis means we have to now go enter into a 100-year war with radical Islam.
It seems
there's
strange.
No connection between these things. It's just a mess. It's stupid science fiction. Like I don't mean to malign science fiction because I love science fiction, but it is a stupid form of science fiction dressed up as some sort of piece of intellectual material that should serve as a foundation for policy, and it is absolutely terrifying. I mean, Paul, can you tell us about the gray champion figure? I mean, I think people really need to know about the gray champion.
Oh, yeah, I want to hear about the gray champion.
Yeah, so I'll talk about the gray champion, and then we'll talk a little bit more about cycles of history and that kind of stuff. So essentially
it's Daenerys Targaryen, isn't it? That's the gray champion.
I don't know. It could be. I think it's Jon Snow. We'll find out, unless he dies again.
I'm rooting for the White Walkers in that one. But go ahead. Tell us about the Great Champion.
So in this, in Strauss and Howe's theory, you know, I mean, it's very much pop sociology. It's geared towards a pop audience. And so it uses a lot of these like made up phrases to define the generational archetypes that they use. So certain people are, you know, the prophet generation or the artist generation. There's the nomad generation and the millennials, which they coined that phrase, so you can blame them for that, are the hero generation. And the hero generation who come up in the fourth turning will be led by a supposed gray champion, which would be a elder statesman of the prophet generation, someone from who are the boomers. So ostensibly a Mr.
Right
Donald,
away, I'm like,
Mr.
Nope.
Donald J. Trump.
Right away, I'm like, nope, no good's coming out of boom generation.
So, I mean, you know, that's what it sounds like. You know, it's like, you know, Gandalf the Grey coming riding over the hill to save us at the battle when the orcs are coming. That, you know, it sounds like a young adult fiction, some dystopian novel. But I mean, you know, that's their theory. It's kind of strange to have somebody in the White House who is very attached to this kind of pop theory. But it's not like, you know, historians kick around cyclical theories all the time.
So,
Arthur Schlesinger had his cycles of American history that proved to be obviously wrong.
Is the idea that the gray champion is Donald Trump, a man who sometimes forgets that Rudy Giuliani is sitting right next to him in the room? That's the gray champion?
I mean...
Speak out loud, man.
You know,
the podcast people can't hear your strange looks.
I can't say if Steve Bannon actually believes who is the gray champion or if he, believes directly in every single little bit of the fourth turning. I don't know what to call it, theology, eschatology, whatever you'd want to describe it as.
Metaphysics.
But, I mean, he certainly has said in speeches, this is the great fourth turning. This is the great fourth, you know, crisis in American history. He clearly believes that we are in an existential crisis that will require some kind of strong leader to get us out of it, and may, as he seems to imply, require a kind of existential bloody fight.
Where does Bannon see the end game here? Because to my mind, you either the earth is either a smoking cinder and the cockroaches have the run of the place, or you have a world where liberal democracy is completely gone.
I mean, if we're going to go by Strauss and Howe's theory, let's just do that. Let's just play along for now.
Let's play along.
They give four specific outcomes of these crises.
Oh, goody. Okay, so what are the four specific outcomes?
So the positive one is we will see a rebirth of America. A new political order will take hold. A greater sense of community will be created. Everybody will be joined together under this new belief.
That's the same thing Geico says about their car insurance, but what are the other outcomes?
So another outcome could be this being the end of America as a successful country. So it could be the end of constitutional democracy as we know it. So that's pretty bad. I think people seem to be talking about that a lot lately.
Yeah.
The third one would be the end of modernity. Because Strauss and Howe trace back their cycles of history back to around the 1500s as the beginning of the modern era that gave rise to the Enlightenment, that gave rise to our current world order. So that could end and we could see another Dark Ages. So that's great. And then the fourth one is we could see omnicidal genocide and the complete obliteration of the human race.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like I'd roll them bones. Fucking A.
This is the dumbest theory in the freaking world. This is so dumb.
So what
it is the case that we're in a moment of crisis right now. Donald Trump's presidency is creating a series of crises for the American government, the American system of government. That's true. The financial crisis was literally a crisis. But that this crap about turnings and regeneration and, oh, Jesus Christ.
I think Steve Bannon would say that you just don't get it, man.
What's weird is that I find oftentimes Steve Bannon seems to have a firmer grip on reality than a lot of leading Republicans who just think that everything is fine with American capitalism, and so long as we repeal a few more regulations.
I think it's important to give Steve Bannon credit for what he gets right. And he gets a lot of things right about the way the country has moved in the wake of the financial crisis.
That's why he scares me more than any other Trump advisor.
It's like he's taken the sort of same knowledge that we've tried to spread in this world. But we've been trying to do it for virtuous purposes and to actually help people.
We are anti-apocalypse.
Right.
This podcast is anti-apocalypse.
Right. And we're also anti-monopolist, you know, and we would like to see strongholds of political and economic power broken up and redistributed to people who don't have them. It's not clear that Steve Bannon actually wants that. I think that Steve Bannon is kind of a monopoly power guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Certainly you're not going to win an apocalyptic war without monopoly power. Am I right?
I mean, in general, monopolies tend to concentrate during times of war so that nation states can organize and mobilize for the war.
That does seem to be the case. I mean, I like to refer to Steve Bannon sometimes as an upside down Bernie Sanders. You know, he sees, you know, oh, there's this global economic crisis, and he talks about it and gave a sort of coherent argument about why this was bad for the right. But his answer is, you know, not necessarily break up the big banks, but like cut government spending, cut regulations, draw up the bridges, kick out the immigrants.
Go to war,
and that, you know, his vision, which overlaps with, you know, what Strauss and Howe talk about, is that all of these things are linked, and he repeatedly says this, like the commodity markets collapses are linked to the migration crisis. That, you know, Muslim radicalism connects up with, you know, a fifth column in America of Muslim organizations, Jewish organizations, and rich liberals who want to undermine the American right. idea through
we want to install Sharia law
through cultural Marxism.
Yes,
you know that this will undermine the so-called Judeo-Christian West. That basically we will allow our civilization to be compromised by a flood of migrants that will destroy America and Christian European civilization along the lines of, say, like the fall of Constantinople. Like, this is the kind of apocalyptic thinking that links up with a sort of not entirely clear Christian eschatology and Catholic history that
very
he
crusader
has.
Oriented. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeep. Oops. This is going to be a pretty bumpy ride for us, guys.
Yep.
But all we have standing in the way of the apocalypse are our staid and hoary democratic norms as enacted by our government bureaucracy. All right. Well, thank you once again for painting us as betwixt and between Scylla and Charybdis. What a great way to end the podcast on. We'll be back next week if we survive. Stick around. We'll be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by Huffington Post reporters Paul Blumenthal, Zach Carter, SV Date, and Arthur Delaney. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Please check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.